You are listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Sabah al-khair, masa al-khair, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I am your host, Ann Lucas. I am recording this within hours of a ceasefire agreement in Gaza going into effect. And Palestinians know the drill. Israel is killing and killing and killing until that ceasefire officially happens. And Israel is also trying to spin the agreement because they want the legal framework to keep up as much of the genocide as possible, even if they agreed in principle to stop. At this moment, I want to share the live commentary and analysis of the ceasefire in Gaza from Dropsite News. I want to share it because I know half of my listeners know about Dropsite News, and I also know the other half does not know about Dropsite News. And it is a wonderful resource everyone should be using and supporting for accurate reporting on Palestine. But also, there has been a lot of live analysis of the terms of the ceasefire, and Dropsite's analysis doesn't seem like it would be everyone's go-to, but if everyone missed it, it definitely is an important analysis from people who know what they are talking about. The founder of Dropsite News, Jeremy Scahill, is part of the conversation, of course. Professor Sami Ararian in Istanbul is too. Sami Ararian is the director of the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul's Zaim University. Sami is Palestinian, and he was a tenured academic for 4 decades in the U.S., as well as being a prominent public speaker here on human rights before taking this position in Turkey. Mohammed Shahada is a big contributor to this analysis of the ceasefire agreement for Dropsite. Mohammed is a writer and civil society activist from Gaza who is a student of development studies at Lund University in Sweden. Mohammed has been a go-to source for me regarding what's happening in Gaza since October 2023, and I am so thrilled he was part of this analysis I am sharing today. We truly have a lot to listen to. So yalla bina, let's go.
I'm Jeremy Scahill from Dropsite News. Thank you very much for joining us on this momentous evening. We now have gotten word that a quote-unquote ceasefire and exchange of captives deal has been agreed to by Hamas and other Palestinian resistance factions and the Israeli government in an agreement that was brokered by the United States, Egypt, and Qatar. And even though there is jubilation right now throughout Gaza, the Israeli military is continuing its assault on the Palestinian people of Gaza. There is a lot to discuss among the factors why this deal took so long when it is virtually identical to a deal that was on the table as of May this past summer. And the Biden administration allowed Benjamin Netanyahu to sabotage that deal. And instead of punishing him, the administration rewarded him with billions of dollars in weapons transfers and political support as Netanyahu expanded his wars throughout the region. We'll be discussing the intervention of President-elect Donald Trump. We'll be talking about the dynamic of the armed resistance in Gaza and the refusal to surrender despite repeated demands that they do so by the United States and Israel. And I'm very honored to be joined by two Palestinian guests. First, from Istanbul, we are joined by Dr. Sami Al-Aryan. He is the director of the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zaim University. And we are also joined by Mohammed Shahada, who is a Palestinian journalist and analyst from Gaza. Thank you both so much for being here. Dr. Sami Al-Aryan, let's begin with you. First, just this is extremely emotional for many Palestinians who have managed to survive this genocide, but also lost so much. Your overall reaction to what now appears to be the first real break that Palestinians are going to get from this U.S.-backed Israeli scorched earth war?
First, thank you for inviting me. It's certainly very emotional and sobering after 466 excruciating days for the Palestinians in Gaza. Now we see possibly the end of this onslaught, of this genocide. Netanyahu announced on the first day that he is going to pacify the resistance, that he is going to end the resistance, defeat, annihilate. And he started his war of extermination for all these days, save the last week of November. So 460 days of continuous bombing. He basically leveled Gaza. There is no civilian structures. There are no one has not been impacted or affected. All 2.3 million people in Gaza have been suffering, whether they suffered martyrdom, they were killed in the course of this war, were injured or displaced or lost loved ones, or been under starvation as well as severe cold. All this suffering was taking place for a simple reason. The Palestinians believe in the justice of their cause. They're not about to submit or surrender to Netanyahu. And we heard him today said he is waiting for Hamas to agree to a deal. In other words, all these 460 plus days were in vain. He was not able to have any of his goals achieved or fulfilled. It was just another onslaught by the Zionist regime against the Palestinians. It is the victory of Palestinian resilience and determination. So it is an emotional time. It's an emotional moment. And they were hoping that the Palestinians in Gaza will have now some kind of an end to this suffering and that they will be able to rebuild their lives again.
Mohammed Shahada, I want to bring you into this discussion as well. You've been doing some of the best reporting of late on the process that has led up to this deal. And we should caveat it by saying that up until this moment, the Israelis have really tried to hedge whether or not there actually is a deal. And there's a degree to which Donald Trump's post on Truth Social seemed to box the Israelis in, where he jumped ahead of everyone else and posted, you know, that we have a deal. But talk about the broad framework of what exactly has been agreed to. This is not a long document. And many of the most specific details are relegated to only describing that first stage of the three-stage deal. But Mohammed, just give us an overview of what exactly has been agreed to at this point.
Thanks so much, Jeremy. And thanks also for all your great reporting. Basically, to start, it's word for word the same deal that Biden proposed on May 31st, primetime TV address, the May 27th formula, as it's known. There's just about six non-substantial changes in an attached appendix, and that's about it. What is going to unfold is a 42 days long pause of hostilities and military operations by Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip, during which there will be a gradual Israeli withdrawal from the Netzarim corridor. So by day 7th, Israel is supposed to evacuate including the Rashid Street that leads to northern Gaza, to allow people to go back on foot or in vehicles. Vehicles will be inspected by a private company to be agreed on. On day 22nd, Israel will complete its withdrawal from the Netzarim corridor that dissects Gaza in two halves. The other corridor that is monumental is the Philadelphia corridor, and there Israel says that it will begin the withdrawal only on day 40 up to day 50. But in the meantime, leading up to that day, the IDF will reduce its forces in that corridor that sort of separates Gaza from Egypt. The Rafah border crossing will be reopened according to the 2005 agreement, which means there will be a European Union monitoring presence, and it will be run by Palestinians, not by Israel. But the IDF will be in the vicinity of the area. They will be around the border crossing, but not inside it. There will be also an exchange of prisoners and captives. And one of the things that I need to emphasize here the most is that Israel is explicitly saying and admitting it is holding 1,000 Gazans as hostages, not detainees, not captives, not prisoners, just as hostages, because it says in the agreement that Israel in the first phase will release 1,000 Gazans who were captured and detained since October 8th and did not, quote, take any part in the October 7th attack. So if they're holding on to those, they're just holding them as bargaining chips, and Israel is going to release them, 1,000 of them, in the first phase, just to give the impression of a large release of Palestinian prisoners to get hostages in return. So that is one monumental thing. There's also an evacuation of wounded Palestinians, including people that Israel is likely to veto by claiming or alleging that they might be affiliated with Hamas or the PIJ or other entities in Gaza. There is an explicit commitment to evacuate them as well. There's also a suspension of Israeli surveillance operations, sort of drones and flights over Gaza in Gaza skies for 10 hours per day. And there will be full freedom of movement for Palestinians in Gaza within the Gaza Strip, minus a buffer zone that the IDF will maintain of up to 700 meters. On day 16 of the first phase, Hamas and Israel are supposed to engage in the second phase negotiations that will entail the release of Israeli soldiers that are currently in Hamas's captivity, and that will entail as well negotiating over the shape of what the day after in Gaza will look like.
Dr. Samuel Arian, I want to ask you on the perspective from the Palestinian resistance factions. Everyone always just says Hamas, but it's not just Hamas. There are numerous groups, including Palestinian Islamic Jihad, that have been a part of these negotiations. And in fact, senior officials from some of the other factions that have been a part of this resistance bloc went to Doha, and then they had a unified agreement on the approach that they would take as they neared a final deal. There is talk in the Israeli media that Netanyahu is sort of telling people that, listen, this is really just going to be a one-phase deal, and then we're going to be able to just resume the war again. That dynamic is out there. But before we get into how Netanyahu may play games or try to just continue on with the genocidal war after this first phase, I want to get your take on what is the perspective of the Palestinian resistance factions on this deal and what they get out of it.
In the early days, in the early weeks of the onslaught, of the Israeli onslaught on the Palestinians in Gaza, they tried to send signals to different groups, different factions, particularly the Islamic Jihad. And they basically says that we can have a deal with you, whatever hostages, whatever captives you have, we can get you a deal. And early on, all the factions, including the Islamic Jihad, rebuffed these attempts, and they told the Egyptians and others that we're only going to have one faction or one mediator, one negotiator, which is Hamas, and that we will coordinate with Hamas. And therefore, all the attempts by the Israelis to divide the resistance were in vain, were not accepted, and were defeated. So at every stage of these negotiations, Hamas would always consult with these different groups. They would reach a consensus on what to go, on what to do next, and then Hamas will carry on with the negotiations. Same thing happened this time around, and I think all the factions have signed on to these negotiations. As Muhammad says, there is actually no much difference. The substance, the structure of the deal that we have today is exactly the same we had 6, 7, 8 months ago. Biden announced in late May that he has a plan that was, he presented even as a Netanyahu, as an Israeli plan, which was vetoed. It was torpedoed by the Israelis. And then they were renegotiated again on July 2nd. It was announced that Hamas has accepted these terms. What they accepted in July is exactly what we have today. people have to ask themselves, so what has changed? What is the new thing that made Netanyahu and his fascist government to accept this deal, which they had rejected back in July? And the only new factor really here is the intervention by Trump, because Trump wanted to be inaugurated next week without having to deal with this mess. He knows that this is going to be a huge detraction for him, whether it in his domestic agenda or whether in his international agenda. He has so many things he'd like to accomplish, and he doesn't want to deal with this situation, particularly there is actually no strategic purpose for it. He told Netanyahu in no uncertain terms, finish the job. That was when he was a candidate. And Netanyahu couldn't finish the job. Finishing the job, people interpreted that as being finish off Hamas, end Hamas, end this war. But I don't want to inherit this war. I don't want to deal with this war. And Netanyahu has promised his people from day one that he will end the resistance in Gaza, that he will defeat Hamas, that they will surrender, that they will release or they will have all the hostages back without having to pay any price, that he would be able to free them without any kind of exchange that would be through military pressure. He's failed on all these accounts. So now we days away from Trump, and Trump said, okay, I've given you the chance. You couldn't do it. Now you have to do it under pressure. And that's the only new factor in this formula, because it's exactly the same formula that Hamas has accepted months ago. Now you say, what is Netanyahu or what is Trump offering in this exchange? And I believe he's giving them some carrots. He's promising them possibly, because Netanyahu is trying to obviously get his right-wing extremist partners to sign on to this, and they haven't, whether it is annexation of land, territories in the West Bank, or whether it's something in Syria or Lebanon, or maybe a strike against Iran, or possibly, and this is probably what Trump has in mind, a deal with Saudi Arabia, a normalization deal with Saudi Arabia, in which Israel would be integrated. Whatever it is that Trump is thinking, he wants to get rid of this war that has not resulted in anything but an absolute disgrace, not only for Israel, but for a complicitous, the United States, which has given Israel all it wants, politically, militarily, you name it, economically, and has, in this situation, lost the whole international order that it has built since World War II.
Mohammed, I want to ask you also about the Trump factor in all of this, but just to remind people that since the summer, none of these people needed to die. This deal could have been on the table. And we were told throughout the election campaign by the Democrats, by the surrogates for the Harris campaign, that they were working tirelessly, that they were working around the clock to achieve a ceasefire. And one of the dimensions here that I think becomes clear is that for whatever anyone thinks of Donald Trump, he utilized tools that are all about the power of the presidency when he hasn't even resumed office yet. And Joe Biden systematically refused to ever use any of the most powerful levers available to an American president to stop this, which leaves the conclusion out there that Biden didn't stop it because he supported it. But I wanted to ask you, because you've been talking to negotiators, to Arab diplomats, to others in the region, what's your assessment of how significant Trump's interventions have been since he became the president-elect?
Monumental. So until recently, mediators would tell me that everything would change if Biden would only call, name and shame Netanyahu, call him out publicly for rejecting and refusing the ceasefire repeatedly since May last year. So basically, everything that was changed is just Trump jumping in and doing that, nothing more. All he needed to do was just apply a little bit of pressure on Netanyahu and say, get a deal done. Netanyahu got it done immediately. Whereas for Biden, as a senior Arab diplomat put it recently to me, she said, Biden is just ideological. Trump is transactional. He's a businessman. Biden, his heart is in it. He's fully devoted to supporting Israel. And he sees any pressure on Israel as, quote, tainting his legacy. He wants his legacy to be the most pro-Israeli president there is ever. So he chose that legacy over Kamala Harris's chance or opportunity to win. Now with Trump, there is another dimension, as Dr. Sami mentioned, there's a transactional dimension that we don't know about yet. We know, of course, that Trump's pressure on Netanyahu sealed the deal. That is something that is undoubted. In the very last minutes of the negotiations, Netanyahu tried to maneuver by insisting on a couple hundred meters of the buffer zone. So now it's 700 meters. He wanted it to be 900 instead. And then Steve Witkoff had to press him and get that compromise out of him and other issues as well, without which a deal would have never been sort of completed. But on the other hand, we are getting reports from Israeli media that are saying that Trump gave Netanyahu a gift bag in return, and that gift bag includes a promise to allow Israel to violate the ceasefire and provide them with cover for it. So in other words, to resume the war on Gaza as soon as the first phase is completed, never going into phase two, just getting 33 hostages out and then back to war again. The gift bag also reportedly includes lifting all Israeli settlers, extremists, settler organizations, Israeli shady tech companies like NSO that is responsible for the Pegasus spyware, lifting all sanctions on those companies and individuals. And number three, allowing Israel a major chunk, a major land grab or land theft in the West Bank. So that might be the case. It checks out. The other thing is that this morning, until the very last minute, we're getting reports from Netanyahu saying that he is stealing Bezalel Smotrich. No, don't worry. It's only going to be a pause. It's not the end of the war. We will resume the war again. And in return, Smotrich asking for, quote, forcing Gazan migration as one of his conditions, is that even if there is a ceasefire, even if the war ends, you need to maintain conditions in Gaza as hell on earth, make it as uninhabitable as possible, ban concrete and cement from going in like Israel did in 2014, prevent reconstruction, and then people will leave, will have no option but to leave or face death by starvation, cold, or disease. So that's pretty much it.
Dr. Al-Aryan, we also have, as it appears that there's at least going to be a pause in Israel's massive attacks against the people of Gaza, aid, we hope, is going to come in as soon as possible. You're going to start to have an exchange of captives. And of course, you know, overwhelmingly, or at times exclusively, the discussion is about the Israelis who are being held in Gaza. But as Mohammed alluded to earlier, there are more than 10,000 Palestinians that are being held at this moment by the Israelis. Thousands of them are being held in what they call administrative detention, which means that they have limited or no access to a lawyer or any form of due process. You have hundreds of children and minors, many of whom have been put through a military court system. And so for Palestinians, the prospect of potentially a couple thousand of their people being freed is a major achievement on the one hand, but it also should remind the world that Israel routinely imprisons hundreds of children, Palestinian children, every year, and holds thousands of Palestinians where they don't even bother to put charges against them. Talk about the different levels of Palestinian prisoner that exist in this deal. You have women, you have children and minors, you have political prisoners, I mean, explicit political prisoners, people who have been imprisoned because of their political organizing, and you have people that have been imprisoned because of their activities as members of the armed resistance against Israel. Talk about the Palestinian prisoners, captives, hostages that we so seldom hear about.
That's correct. Before October 7th, there were about 5,700 Palestinians in Israeli prisons, 1,800 of which were under what is called administrative detention. These are people who are arrested and were arrested without any charges. They never had any pending charges against them, yet they were in prison, they were in custody, they were mistreated. Many of them, hundreds of them, were children, not only under 18, but sometimes even under 15. Many women who have never been charged with anything, separated from their families. This is part of a routine by the Israeli army in order to check the Palestinians, meaning in order to make the Palestinians fear them all the time. That's the only way they can keep the occupation going and not having millions of Palestinians in the West Bank revolt against this occupation. They want to rule them with as few Israeli soldiers as possible. So part of the tactics is to go and storm these houses. There are numerous reports by human rights groups, including Israeli human rights groups. They talk about this in great details. Now, this is routine for Israel. Many of the people who have gone through trials, these were sham trials. People would be charged with certain crimes under torture, under confessions, signed in Hebrew, a language that most Palestinians do not understand or know. And then they would be sentenced to a lot of years, sometimes even to life in prison for stuff that they would either have extracted under torture or under coercion. And they really have no recourse because Israeli justice does not exist when it comes to the Palestinians. Now, add to this, at the beginning of 2023, this whole Israeli system of justice or injustice was controlled in the prisons by Itamar Ben-Gavir, the new Israeli right-wing minister, in which he started taking what he calls privileges from these Palestinians. These Palestinians, under this Israeli system, in the Israeli prisons, have gained through a struggle of decades certain things, such as the right to education, the right of pray together, the right of visitation, the right of cooking, certain things. He started taking them one by one because he said these people are criminals and they need to be treated as such and they need to be under extreme pressure. So part of the reason of what happened on October the 7th, 2023, was these cries coming from these prisoners, that it become the even life in prison became unbelievable because it became very much a life of torture for them. Now, after October 7th, Israel started without any restraints whatsoever. Whatever restraints they had before, it was very few. Now they started actually arresting people left and right, not only in Gaza by grabbing whatever they can come to the adults. Few weeks ago, they had the head of the hospital, Kamal Adwan Hospital, a very respected doctor, the director of that, being arrested in plain sight. Why? Because he was treating his patients and he refused to leave when the orders came that he had to leave. He wanted to stay with the last patient that they couldn't move. Then he went to the actual tank telling Israelis about the situation. They just arrested him and put him in prison. Now he's being tortured, we have reports, in one of the notorious prisons. The prison in which guards actually admitted they were raping Palestinians. We have many reports about rapes, about torture. This is routine in Israeli prisons. So that's the type of environment that the Palestinians have been living under, not just now, not just in the last year, but even much earlier, since the 1967 occupation. And even before then, you have this system that is trying to torment the Palestinians so they will never resist, that they will give up this notion that they can resist Israeli occupation and Israeli control of their lives. Now,
Sammy, go ahead, finish your thought.
No, I just wanted to say that now we have thousands of people. So what this deal is going to do is to get many of these people out of this prison, out of this misery, whether it is after October 7th, thousands of people would be released, and they are not under trial. I mean, they're just in mass detentions, and some people say that they are in a very, very small, crowded rooms, as well as those who have been sentenced to life sentences and large and long sentences as well. They will also be part of this deal.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, and either of you can take this, but you know, in addition to the categories of prisoner, Palestinian prisoner that you're discussing, Dr. Al-Arian, you also have people that were leaders of the resistance that are in prison. Most commonly, we talk about Marwan Barghouti, who in some circles he's compared to being a kind of version of a Palestinian Nelson Mandela. And there are, you know, he's always been at the top of the list that Hamas has submitted, that they want him out. Israeli officials have been telling people no chance that they're going to release Barghouti. But Sammy or Mohammed, talk about some of the other high profile prisoners that are serving very long sentences and who they are that the resistance is asking to be freed as part of this deal.
You want to take that one, Mohammed, or you want me?
Now you can go ahead.
Well, one of them, his name is Nail Barghouti. Nail Barghouti is the same name as also Marwan Barghouti. Barghouti family is very well known as a family that has produced many, many people, freedom fighters. Nail has been in prison now for probably half a century. He was released briefly, and then he was rearrested after he was his sentence was completed. And they don't want to give him up. They want to just keep torturing him, tormenting him. So he's very prominent in the Palestinian struggle. You also have Ahmed Saadat. Ahmed Saadat is also a leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, one of the main factions that have been in existence since the 1960s. And also he has been arrested and he's been tried in a sham trial and he's been sentenced to life. And you have other groups from all factions. You have the Islamic Jihad has many people who have been also sentenced to life and long sentences, as well as people from Hamas. One of the things that Israel has demonstrated to the resistance is that it does not release people because of agreements, of so-called peace agreements or settlements. Because in the 1993 Oslo, there was a stipulation that this is going to be a new phase by which Israel is going to release many of these prisoners that it has been detaining and it has been holding because they didn't want any kind of resistance. So now that we have a new phase, that we turn the phase, that they're going to release them. But Israel insisted on keeping many of these prisoners, many of these captives, despite the agreement. Actually, Clinton, during his time, when it was the White River Agreement or other kind of agreements or other kind of negotiations before the 2000 Camp David, he was intervening and interjecting with Netanyahu and other Israeli governments to keep their word to release these Palestinians. So that sometimes they would release few here and few there, but never in mass numbers. Until the Shalit deal came along in 2011, and Palestinians now saw that the only language that Israel understands is the language of force. Because with one captive, with one Israeli soldier, which is Shalit, Gilad Shalit, they were able to get over 1,000 Palestinians released, some of them in long sentences, including, by the way, somebody like Sinwar and others. So now the Palestinians...
Well, literally including Yahya Sinwar and, yes, and his brother Mohammed was one of the key people involved with that operation. And Mohammed Sinwar, a very important figure in the armed resistance right now, particularly in the south of Gaza.
That's correct. So the lesson learned by the Palestinians is that negotiations don't produce results. Your loved ones will stay in prison and die in prison. But if you dare to challenge the Israeli army and just get one of them out, then you'll be able to release thousands. And that's one of the reasons why we had October 7th, by the way.
You know, I want to ask about some of the technical aspects of this related to this notion that Israel clearly has an intent at any moment it can find a justification to start intensifying its attacks against Gaza. One of the things that was a source of dispute all the way up until the last moments was an issue of where Israeli forces are going to be positioned when they quote unquote withdraw. And there's an issue of a buffer zone that's going to be within Gaza. You've been going through all of these components of the deal carefully. Mm-hmm. Can you walk people through what does it actually mean that Israeli forces are going to draw back or are going to withdraw? And talk about this issue of the border zone. And there was a dispute about maps. The Hamas delegation was saying the Israelis don't want to provide us with actual detailed maps showing where their troops are going to be coming from and going to. So that, and my understanding is that the reason that this was so important to the Palestinian negotiators is because in the past, Israel has exploited any vagueness that exists within the framework of documents to try to justify their own violations of these agreements. I just threw a lot at you, but can you walk us through that general architecture of what does it mean for them to be withdrawing in these phases and the issue of the buffer zone?
Sure, absolutely. So what it means in the phases is that now Israel will begin negotiations with Hamas on day 16 of the first phase on what the second phase will look like. If they don't get to an agreement, phase one will continue to be extended indefinitely. That was Biden's proposal, which means that Netanyahu can simply create phase one as the new status quo in Gaza. That's the best case scenario, is basically Netanyahu trying to negotiate with Hamas and saying that I demand that every single Hamas member in Gaza packs their things and moves to Mars or the moon. And if you don't, we will continue to negotiate indefinitely and we'll never get to phase two, where you will have an increase of humanitarian aid going into Gaza, or phase three, where you have the reconstruction beginning. So basically, what phase one looks like is that the IDF will keep about 700 meters buffer zone all around the Gaza Strip in its entirety, which means it's an area, when it sounds like 700 meters, doesn't sound much, but when you say it's the circumference of the Gaza Strip in its entirety, then it's about 15 to 20% of Gaza's area. And it's the arable lands, it's the agricultural lands, it's the majority of these, as well as entire towns. You have Beit Hanun being swallowed by one of these buffer zones, a whole town being swallowed in an area the IDF wants to stay in. The other point of contention is that the IDF said in the appendix, the updated appendix that they just agreed on, is that Israel will stay in 5 points in that buffer zone with 400 meters extra. It did not specify which 5 points these are, where the precise location would be, which is why Hamas insisted on maps, because 5 points is very general and vague. It means that Israel can just say, this is the point today, tomorrow it's this other point, and then keep sweeping the Gaza Strip back and forth indefinitely. All the loopholes that we see now in the ceasefire deal with Lebanon, that Israel is exploiting as much as possible to continue to attack Hezbollah and to continue to level and wipe out entire Lebanese villages in the south. There are also a lot of loopholes that we've seen with the Oslo Accords that Israel exploited. For example, there was one where it said something about Israel withdrawing from lands instead of saying the lands. And that just those three letters that were missed out there, deliberately left out, Israel exploited it to violate the Oslo Accords into virtual obsolescence. So in that regard, up until now, my understanding is that the maps are still an issue of discussion. They are still waiting on the final maps to be presented to know where the IDF is going to be. There was also another point where Israel says that the IDF will be around the Rafah border crossing, but not inside it. They wanted a precise map to show what does around it mean, because that can mean that Israel cuts the main road leading people in and out of Gaza, or humanitarian aid, and thus gets full control over it, prevents journalists from going in. One of the main things that Israel is extremely worried about is journalists and fact-finding missions going into Gaza and showing us the full extent of the genocide that's been being hidden largely from our view for the last 15 months. So in that regard, if the IDF gets to cut the main roads, they can just continue to prevent it. And that's the insistence on the maps. There are other loopholes as well. It does not say that this is an agreement of a ceasefire. It says this is an agreement of sustainable calm or sustainable quiet that will lead, which will lead to a permanent ceasefire between the two sides, which can be also another loophole that Israel exploits. So as we've seen numerous times, Netanyahu will spare no effort to continue the war again. He's just saying it today, this morning. It was all over Israeli news as well. One of the things that Israelis found most devastating, it was all over Israeli media. They called it the condition that we're not informed about, is basically Israeli media was devastated that this first phase of the ceasefire will allow Gazans, 1 million displaced Gazans in the south, to return to the north again. They wanted that entire northern half of Gaza to be carved out and zoned for settlements, for Israeli settlements and buffer zones. So they were extremely disappointed. What it means for the IDF to be at the buffer zone, that's my last sentence, is basically at any minute they can just redeploy in the very heart of Gaza and there is no stopping them. They can reestablish the Netzarim corridor or the Miflasim corridor between Jabalia and Gaza City, or the other corridors like Kisufim or Sofa between Deir el-Balah and Khan Yunis and Khan Yunis and Rafah, and cut Gaza into 5 separate isolated concentration camps again. That was the IDF plan right before the ceasefire, what was called the 5-finger policy. So that can be implemented at any minute. With IDF troops being inside Gaza as well, Israel can at any minute claim that, oh, we spotted Hamas militants organizing sort of an operation or a militant activity or trying to regroup. Therefore, we are conducting a precise raid on this neighborhood to thwart it. That can be the claim, while in effect, it's just continuing the assault. So there is a lot of worry here.
Yeah, and you mentioned there Israel's concerns about non-Palestinian journalists going into Gaza, because if you have CNN and Sky News and BBC and others on the ground there that are actually then going to witness the aftermath of what the Israelis have done, this is not going to go well for Israel. You know, they've tended to only want to bring in journalists that they control and subject to their censorship rules. And I feel like I must note that roughly 200 of our colleagues have been killed in Gaza. And I say colleagues, every Palestinian journalist and media worker is our colleague. And it has been utterly shameful that Western journalists have stood by silently while our colleagues have been not just killed as so-called collateral damage, but in several cases, hunted down and murdered because they are journalists. And in some cases, their family members have also been explicitly targeted and killed. And I will say it every day, it is shameful that more Western journalists have not stood up for our colleagues. You know, when an American journalist gets imprisoned in Moscow, you have famous journalists from CNN and elsewhere tweeting about it every single day. Well, they have treated our colleagues, our Palestinian colleagues in Gaza, as some kind of disgusting version of Israel's squid game against journalists, where they're putting them through this dystopic reality where any day they could just be killed for doing their jobs and intentionally killed. Our colleague Abu Bakr Abed, brave, brave journalist who reports for Dropsite News, spoke at a press conference the other day when he talked about how the world has witnessed the bodies of Palestinian journalists being mangled and murdered in every possible way, and yet so many have stood by silently. So I stand in solidarity with our colleagues in Palestine, specifically in Gaza, who are enduring an unconscionable horror, the likes of which we've never seen in the journalistic profession. We only have a few moments left, but Dr. Sami Al-Aryan, I think we must talk about the West Bank, because while Israel may pause, hopefully it ends, but may pause its war against the Palestinians of Gaza, it is intensifying right now in the West Bank. This is the second day in a row that Israel has conducted its own airstrikes inside of the West Bank. Last night, they struck in Jenin, and this comes on the tail of the Palestinian Authority security forces, which many Palestinians view as an extension of the Israeli occupation, engaging in their most significant military operation against not just the resistance in Jenin and elsewhere, but also, according to Mariam Barghouti, who reports for Dropsite News from the West Bank and just did a great, powerful story from Jenin, that it is effectively collective punishment also against the broader population. There are concerns that Israel may try to officially, formally annex the West Bank. It seems quite clear that the aggressive expansion of settlements is going to continue. Talk about what's happening right now in the West Bank, Sami, and what you think the relationship to a potential Gaza deal now going through into effect in just days. Paul, you're muted there, Dr. Al-Aryan. Sorry, go ahead.
Part of the argument Netanyahu is using with his fascist extremist partners is that he's promising them that they will cash in on the West Bank. Early on in this cabinet, in this right-wing cabinet that Netanyahu formed in late 2022, early 2023, was a plan, because he gave Smotrich basically free hand to build settlements, to increase the settlers inside the West Bank. The West Bank under Oslo has been divided into three zones, what they call zone A, B, and C. A is where the Palestinian Authority, which is simply a collaborator, it is the first line of defense for the occupation and the settlers. It controls basically the major Palestinian population centers, about 18% of the land and about over 80% of the population. Zone B, even though it has both administrative and security control, Israel can enter at any moment and actually invade, kill, arrest whatever it wants and leaves. And when that happens, they just disappear. They melt, the Palestinian Authority forces. Then you have Zone B, in which administratively they are under the Palestinian Authority. It's about 22% of the land mass of the West Bank. The West Bank is about 5,500 square kilometers. And then security-wise, it's under Israel. And then you have Zone C, which has less than 8% of the Palestinian population. And basically, it's controlled administratively and security-wise, not only by Israel, but today under actually the control of Smotrich, one of the most hardcore Zionists and extremist politicians in the Zionist regime. He has promised early on that he is going to annex as much of this land as possible and to populate it and to sit with as many settlers as possible. He said today we're around 750 or a little more. Within a few years, we're going to get to a million, and then we're going to go to our next million. Then he proposed to the Palestinians, said, you Palestinians have one of three options. Option one is that you have to submit to the state of Israel that you're not going to be a citizen, that you're basically a person there subject to the Jewish state, and you have no civil or political rights. And I understand that you don't like that. Then the alternative is you get compensated and leave. And if you don't accept these two options, the third option is you get killed. And basically, Ben-Gavir added to this, he started arming settlers. So within last year and the year before, over 150,000 settlers were armed to the teeth. This is just a free program in which they will give these settlers arms and starting harassing and intimidating and provoking and killing and burning Palestinian crops and Palestinian homes and killing Palestinians so that they can force them to leave the West Bank. So the next battle after Gaza, this is what's going to determine actually the future of the Palestinian cause, is what's going to take place in the West Bank. Because they are intent, these people, these extremists, they think they have a chance in order to end the Palestinian cause once and for all. And to do that, they need to displace the Palestinians further to annex the land. And that's why Smotrich, when he was celebrating Trump's triumph after he won the presidency, basically he was saying now it's our time to take over and annex the West Bank, or at least 60%, which is Area C. They think by doing that, they can end the Palestinian cause. Then it's on to Jerusalem and Al-Aqsa to build the third temple. And of course, after that comes the integration of Israel in the regional order by having this normalization deal with Saudi Arabia. And then there will never be a Palestinian state. There will never be any kind of Palestinian homeland. The Palestinians will either be displaced or they will have to be subject of Israel. One of the early goals of Israel in Gaza was to try to displace as many Palestinians from Gaza as possible. That failed miserably despite all the enormous bombing that took place. Over 15 Hiroshimas were sent on Gaza, were rained in Gaza for 460 plus days. And despite that, the Palestinians never left and they were never went anyplace, even though 2 million of them have left their homes.
We only have a minute or so left, Mohammed, but I wanted to ask you, we now know that there are reports that the Israeli military has been given orders to operate with maximum force in Gaza around the clock until this ceasefire agreement takes effect. What should people, Mohammed, be looking for in the coming days and in the initial phase of this that would be a make or break moment?
Well, as you said, Israel is now going to escalate and accelerate the killing and destruction of Gaza to the maximum possible. That's why Netanyahu wants to enforce the deal only on the eve of Trump's inauguration on Sunday night until the last minute. Those days whenever there was news of ceasefire negotiations holding a breakthrough, people in Gaza would immediately call it the revenge days, that the IDF goes on a revenge campaign, maximizing the killing and destruction as much as possible. And one of the things we would be looking out for is actually Israeli airstrikes on Gaza, potentially killing some of the hostages, which would have a huge potential in undermining a deal. There are certain high-profile hostages that if they come out in body bags, it might influence Israeli public opinion or create a shock there to allow for the resumption of the war again. So these indiscriminate airstrikes are a huge risk to the lives of Israeli hostages and to the ceasefire deal in its totality. The other thing, as you mentioned, like Israel bombed people that are celebrating on the street that there was a ceasefire announcement. They just killed 20 people since the ceasefire announcement was made. I'm literally going through the contact list of loved ones in Gaza and friends and family to celebrate this moment with. And it's hitting me slowly when I go name by name and realize that most of my loved ones in Gaza are either killed, missing, or unreachable. I haven't managed to get a hold of anyone there. And every minute that passes is a danger to those that are left.
Yeah, and it's such a powerful reminder listening to you, Mohammed, that every time we talk to any Palestinians in our lives, they've all lost people. They've all lost family members. I know, because I know the Al-Aryan family personally, I know that Dr. Sami Al-Aryan's wife has lost over 200 members of her family in Gaza. And it's something that I think all journalists should keep in mind, that when you're interviewing Palestinians about what's happening in Gaza, this is not just some abstract academic conversation, that you all have the temerity, the bravery, the integrity to actually be able to analyze what is ultimately an attempt to wipe your entire people off the map. And I think people should be sensitive to that when they speak to Palestinians. We're deeply grateful for the work and the analysis of both of you. Dr. Sami Al-Aryan, thank you so much for being with us and for all of your work. And Mohammed Shahada, thank you for such great work that you've been doing, not just on the issue of the ceasefire negotiations, but all throughout these past 16 months documenting the horrors on the ground in Gaza. Thank you both.
Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you for DropSight.
Thanks so much for your great work as well.
Thank you. And thank you to all of our readers, our listeners, our viewers for joining us here. We're going to try to do more of these live events when breaking news happens, when significant events happen. We have new stories that are going to be coming out over the course of what transpires as a result of this agreement. We always appreciate the support of our subscribers. If you can afford to become a paid subscriber, go to dropsitenews.com. If you don't have the funds to be able to be a paid subscriber, don't worry. We do not put things behind the paywall. We ask for support from our readers so that we can bring you voices from the ground all around the world. We are a 501c3 organization, so your donations to DropSight News also are tax deductible. We're so deeply grateful. We've surpassed 300,000 subscribers. And we actually know that an enormous number of you open our articles when you receive them in your inbox. And we notice that. We're deeply grateful. We thank everyone who has joined our comment sections. We have some incredibly smart and dedicated readers. On behalf of the entire team at DropSight News, I want to thank you for tuning in. Please continue to check our social media feeds. We have an incredible group of people that are basically running a news service on X/Twitter. Make sure to check it out. There's really, really important work that's being done around the clock, particularly on Gaza and the West Bank. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Jeremy Scahill. We'll see you at dropsitenews.com.
We are out of time, but of course I want to remind you that it takes a village to produce a show like This Week in Palestine. Many, many thanks to Bob Funk and Mohammed Al-Ghul, with additional thanks to Stan Robinson and Steve Lowe. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we thank you for spending your time with us today, as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week.
Thank you.